My text for today, I want you to go to Genesis, in chapter 41, verse 14. When Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. He shaved himself and changed his clothes and came to Pharaoh. What's interesting here is that Joseph had the sense to be able to position himself in the context that Pharaoh is most accustomed to. What's interesting about shaving himself is Jews have beards. They have beards because beards are a sign of honor and maturity. And no doubt in the prison system, it really didn't matter what kind of GQ fashion you had. So they probably all had beards. But the moment that Joseph is summoned before Pharaoh, he recognizes that the Egyptians abhor facial hair. It even says that somewhere in the Bible. And since they don't like facial hair, of course, that's why Yul Brynner was in the movie. Because of the wise casting choice. And so Joseph, the point is, he contextualizes himself with the best that he can to go into the presence of Pharaoh. So this is a classic case, and I understand this. I appreciate this, because I worked in Babylon. I worked in Babylon for years. I worked in Babylon, New York, which is a literal city in Long Island, and my corporate office was in Babylon. And I was a Pentecostal. I had to learn how to talk Babylonian, but think like a Jew. Because my spiritual condition was that I wanted to change the world and have revival. I didn't want to be involved with Babylonian culture. But you have to be able to do your wardrobe changes. And of course, I think that the Lord was speaking to me last night. He said, stop talking about people going through the Joseph story. We're a very narcissistic culture. Everybody's all obsessed with their Joseph journey, which usually is their victim story about something they screwed up that they think God put them through. And in order to teach them something, we must be a very teachable community because we're always learning something that we're not responsible for. But here's the idea. The Lord starts saying to me, prepare my people to be a corporate Joseph. Because it's not about individuals. It's about the collective people. We are called to be a corporate Joseph company. And what is the essence of a Joseph company, if you want to think about it, as one facet of what a statesman is? Chapter 40 of Genesis. Verse 6 says, Joseph came in to them, these guys, in the prison, while he's in the prison, in the morning. And they were looking sad. He realized they were sad. Now, one thing you got to know about Joseph right away is that even though he's in prison, even though he's been put there based on trumped up rape charges, even though this man has been betrayed by his brothers, he has some kind of command over his state regardless of the contradicting circumstances. And the secret is the Lord was with him. If you can cultivate an awareness that God is with you, even though you don't know what he's doing, this is the maddening part. Joseph did not know what God was doing. See, he didn't have the solace of saying, well, the Lord's obviously got me going through a contradiction. This is a Joseph case. No doubt my prophecy is going to be fulfilled sometime soon. I'll just kind of whistle while I work. He wasn't that way. The reason why you know that wasn't what he was thinking was the moment that he had access to the butler. He explained to him that he was an innocent Jewish victim of circumstances and needed to return home quickly. He had no sense that his destiny was in Egypt. He thought it was a big mistake. His consolation was he cultivated a sensitivity to the anointing. This is an Old Testament Jew who had more sense, more awareness, you can say, of the Lord being with him than many Pentecostals who pray in tongues. I think we ought to learn from the mystical arts of knowing when the peace of God is there and the benediction of God is there and the goodness of God is in your life to be content that God is working out the contradiction you're going through for your good. Well, you're all looking at me kind of strange. Let me keep moving on this thing. He had the presence of God, so therefore he could judge other people's status or state. He was a state changer, even in a contradiction. Think about what Paul Jelly was teaching yesterday, Daniel in Babylon. It really is a kind of disturbing picture that God could be in captivity. God could be initiating captivity. That God could be putting people in position within the context of a captivity. But what you've got to do is you've got to get yourself out of associating your state of mind and happiness with the scenario you had planned. Which is why pastors that are going for depression conditioning because they're upset about same-sex marriage. I heard John Kelly, which is, this is a totally weird conversation to him, how people are getting depressed because of current events aren't working out right. To a boxer, to a fighter, to a football player, it's like, he doesn't get that. I don't get it either, but I'm just saying that the fact is that people are having meltdowns because things aren't working out the way they thought. Well, my gosh, you have any idea what's about to happen? I'm listening to Dennis. I shouldn't listen to Dennis. I should listen to him because I listened to him and Mark Noddle. I got educated. I've developed like trauma whiplash over the last 7 years.
That's true.
I'm really feeling a credibility issue now because things better go bad quickly. I've been talking about this long enough. I got a lot of equity on this collapse. So anyway, where was I going? Let's get it. So here we are. Joseph was someone who could alter the state of other people because he always took responsibility to be in an empowered condition himself. If Joseph could be in an empowered condition, not knowing what God was doing, and in a prison, that tells you a characteristic of a corporate Joseph is someone who refuses to surrender their state to their circumstance, no matter how contradictory it appears to be. And that is the essence of an overcomer. An overcomer is like a cork. You hold it down, but by its very nature, it pops up to the surface because its disposition is walking in the grace and favor of God, in spite of not knowing what's going on. And so, here we have the essence of a Joseph company. He says, why are you so sad? How could he say that? Because he wasn't. And they said to him, we have dreamed a dream and there's no interpreter for it. There you've got your job description. Your job is to find somebody who has something they're called to do that's a legitimate calling and an assignment on their life that they can't complete until you come on the scene. You have to find somebody. And here's the best part. Find a worthy wolf. Find a heathen who has been given a dream. This will flip you out because we're all about Christians, getting to the top, being the head and up the tail, being the bum. Is he a Christian candidate? Is he born again? I don't think this guy's really born again. How about this? How about, if you're really going to be like the Joseph Daniel company, you're serving a heathen ruler. But it's a heathen God chose. Therefore, it's a receptive heathen. You want to look for a worthy wolf, and you want to become the indispensable Jew. That's the secret of Daniel. That's his secret sauce. That's Joseph's secret sauce. That's Esther's secret sauce. That's Nehemiah's secret sauce. You want to be able to realize that God actually moves through heathen rulers in his grand plan for the ages. And what he does is he shapes culture, not through the heathen ruler, but through whoever is advising the heathen ruler. You all know this old story, you know, there's the head. But everybody knows man may be the head, but the woman is the neck, and the neck can turn the head any direction she wants. I found that out with my marriage. I'm the head of this house. Where am I going? I don't know. Ask him. Anyway. So Joseph changed. The great thing about Joseph is he could shave. He could come out of the dungeon. And he was ready. You know why? Because he was practicing his skills, convergence skills, in the context he was already in. Let me tell you, the gift that you've got is already operating now. It's not maybe operating as well as you need to. Focus on mastery in your present circumstance, because your present circumstance is going to be the phase out of which you go to minister to the next level. So for David, he's got a few sheep. I know pastors that got a few sheep. I know businesses that just got a few sheep. I know people that got this big crisis because they're not big enough or significant enough. It doesn't really matter. Because if you're really anointed for an assignment, God brings into your little context the subset of every big thing you're going to have to deal with later. So your little flock becomes where you deal with casting out a demon that is big enough so that it's the same spirit you're going to face in a much larger scenario later. Does that make sense to you? In other words, God's great. He puts you in the gym. So what Dennis is talking about the training has to suit the mission. Well, the good news is most of us never really know the mission. We're fumbling along trying to find it. But if we're open to the call of God, we get into fights. We don't know how we got there. We don't know why we're there. Just assume it's part of your preparation for your greater assignment. Because Joseph and David both are on the throne of convergence. And at that moment, all the tumblers clicked and they said, oh, shoot, this is what God meant. They realized this is fulfillment of the prophecy. In other words, they were running from Saul, running from caves. David's running over here and there. Joseph's dealing with Potiphar's wife, being in it, trying to learn the language, trying to get the heck home, getting stuck in prison, being forgotten for 2 years. By the time he comes in empowerment, he's having a gestalt experience when his brothers are in front of him. He's like, whoa, all the emotions are coming out. It's all coming together for him in a moment of time. All the suppressed pain of a journey that God was willing to let him go through, but not willing to let him keep. Because in convergence, you get to see the reversal. Hallelujah. So, the corporate Joseph or dream interpreters, you've got to figure out, now, do you have the tool? I'm going to say this, I was thinking about this. Just because you're gifted, just because you're talented, doesn't mean necessarily have all the tools in the toolkit. You've got to have a slingshot. So David was a good warrior, but you need a slingshot. So we should take a look at some slingshots. But my subject today is Joseph, David, and Deborah. Is it David and Deborah? I hope it is. Joseph, David, and Deborah. Because they really fit. I'm going to give you some quick thoughts on this. I'm just going to say that Joseph was practicing state changing and environment changing in the context he was in already. He wasn't waiting for his call to Pharaoh. As a matter of fact, he wasn't even expecting a call to Pharaoh. He was expecting a call home. Which tells you that the ultimate fulfillment of your calling may be in the world system. I want to say this because this is really going to mess with a lot of our thinking. I remember John Schrock, a guy who did an incredible job with a thing called the LARED. I researched all these models that actually work as opposed to theoretic ideas. And in the LARED category, it's just a simple thing. This guy was an Amish businessman who had an encounter with an angel. Actually, he was an Amishman who had an encounter with an angel in a barn. And he encounters the gospel. Somehow he gets saved. I know angels aren't supposed to preach, but it's a complicated story. The angel shows him that Jesus is Lord. He goes and reads the Bible. He gets saved. Goes to the bishops of the Amish church. Explains to them that this religion thing they're into is all mixed up. And they kick him out. He's excommunicated from the Amish. Okay. So he becomes a businessman. Starts this really cool business. And starts writing principles from the Bible for leadership. And creates a curriculum, a 52-week curriculum. He's going to start with two guys, Bernie and Jerry Anderson. Bernie and Jerry. So Bernie and Jerry are both in a rock group. But he hires them, and they're in his paper company. They sell advertising. He's mentoring these guys, just two guys, every week with the boss. They do a principle. They do a principle. Next thing you know, they're teaching them how to do finances, how to do their marriage, how to do life, how to think. These two guys become rich working for him. They end up going into business for themselves. But they discovered that they have a methodology for discipling people based upon principles and values for an hour a week discussing things. That's a slingshot, baby. That's so simple. That's as elementary as it gets. But what happens is, over a period of time, they go to South America. They start doing business groups and circles of leaders and business guys that are all doing the curriculum with them. And for 10 years, nothing happens until, boom, convergence. Something happens. They hit some critical mass. Critical mass in the form of a man by the name of General Cifuentes, who is fighting the rebel FARC forces that are also the drug runners in Colombia, and it's a major militarized opposition party. And he's there with his son from Johns Hopkins University, educated pediatric heart surgeon, one of the best pediatric heart surgeons in the world. And the son decides that rather than make money in the United States, where his job offers, he's going to go to Colombia and operate on children's hearts. However, his father and he were discussing his career one day when they were riding through the jungle in a jeep, and seven of the FARC rebels ambushed them, assassinated the father and the son. The father survived with three bullet holes. The son didn't survive. The father made an amazing statement after he came to himself in the hospital. He made a decision that the violence and the senseless violence in Colombia was going to be dealt a death blow by him, that he wasn't going to go on a vendetta to deal with the people that killed his son. He would go on a vendetta to kill the source that's killing people. And so he has to be reassigned to the prison system because he felt the lowest and worst part for the recruiting of criminals comes out of their penal system, which is corrupt, and he wanted to reform it. He didn't have a clue what to do. He had one thing, the power of intention. And I would say the force multiplier was forgiving his enemies. And this is an interesting story. So I get abducted one night, and I'm getting off a plane, and some guys named Bernie and Jerry invited me to come to meet with them, and I'm getting taken out. I don't forget this. I flew into like Cincinnati, and we're driving out through the country. We're going further and further into the country in a van with a guy I don't know, and I'm thinking, I'm really crazy with this, my calling. I don't know where the heck I'm going. This guy could be a Satanist for all I know, taking me out and making me a human sacrifice. And I don't even vet these people. And we're driving along. And at some point, I must have looked because I start asking him questions like, so tell me a little bit more about how we connected and who you are. And he goes, I guess you're wondering where I'm taking you, aren't you? I go, well, we are leaving the city. We're on lonely country roads. I mean, is there civilization where you live, or is it some kind of a Tolkien village in a hut? So he said, yeah, he said, we actually live in an Amish town. He said, I'm taking you there because our background is our business and our organization works right in an Amish community. And it's a real story about how principles and values can change culture. But trust me, you're safe. And, I know this is crazy, but we really believe you're supposed to be here. I get there, and there's like three rows of Colombian military people with headsets on. This is like something out of, you know, this is what I used to, when I used to do magic mushrooms, this is what I would experience. But I knew I was tripping back then. Now it's like, and they've got these headphones on, and there's some, you know, attractive looking, like, Spanish lady. And she's like talking. And they're all going, and these guys are talking, they want me to do my Seven Mountain story. Okay. Whiteboard ready to go? Here we do our Seven Mountain. And they're all going, And so he says, well, they really love your Seven Mountain stuff, but we're working in the prison system because we've actually got a way that we've reduced prison murders from a murder a day to no murders. I said, well, my investigative reporting instinct stuck. And I said, where? How? Prove it. They said, would you like to, you know, want to go to Bogota and go to the prison? This is like your idea of a vacation, right? I'm going to go to the prison in Bogota. I'll probably get locked in with the inmates and discuss how life is. That's what I do in my free time when I'm not in vans with sickness. So I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. I want to check this story out. Well, I find out that that attractive lady is actually hired by General Cifuentes in order to find a solution to the violence problem and the corruption in the prison. And what she comes across is this business group that's got a curriculum called the Red, and then this crazy Seven Mountain idea, and the fact that maybe we could take these principles and values into certain spheres and sectors and institutions of government, silos, but go in and give them revelation of, get this, by the law of the law comes the knowledge of sin. We've forgotten this. We've gotten so into the mechanics of preaching Billy Graham style, evangelism explosion style. Now we got Pentecostal, sit-soak, and seeker-sensitive church building. It's like a giant soul trap. We seduce them in with 15 minutes of music and hopefully slip them something that gets them saved before they walk out. But by the law comes the knowledge of sin. And so what we found out was the law is what culture needs. The question is, how do you convey timeless principles in a way that doesn't sound preachy? So what they do is they study about anger, they study about forgiveness, they study about self-control, they study about achievement, they study about handling money. These are like 52 modules that are life-discipling principles and values. None of them are religious. None of them are overtly religious, although you can see that these guys did a pretty lousy job of converting the Christianese into the secular, like the top of one chapter I'm reading. He that waters another will also be watered himself. That pretty much sounds like a Bible thing to me. I don't know. But that was the best they could come up with. But it worked. So I found out that the guards, after about 20 weeks, got convicted. Because there's something about the probing of conscience individually that doesn't work. If a person's sneaking around watching porn, nobody else is looking, they're stuck in the porn. But as soon as someone else comes in, oh, I'm not watching porn. So what happens is the conscience is quickened by other consciences wandering around it. So what you do in private is one thing, but what you do when you are traveling, you just have the port 2x2. You can pretty much go anywhere 2x2 and not get into trouble. So, you know, I tell young people, I say, if you're going to go to the bars and evangelize, go in teams of two or threes and keep an eye on each other, make sure the bar isn't evangelizing you while you're evangelizing it. I've been there myself in many an expedition that went awry in my younger years. Doing my research. So, anyway. So what happens is, the conscience gets reinforced. So here's what the guys are doing. They're saying after around 20 weeks, it takes about 20 weeks for the conscience. Think about the conscience. It's dead. Our mission, all this stuff, Dennis, we're talking about in terms of culture, even the mechanisms of economic recoveries, we are really dealing with the deadened culture of conscience and creating a common access to it that, you know, it's so hard to do. We're trying to stimulate the God part of people's awareness of right and wrong, true and false, and say there's a better way to play the game than the way you're playing it. And the conscience of people will commend and agree with you if you're really good at doing this, because they all do agree with the idea. So around 15 minutes or 15 weeks, 20 weeks into the interviews, into the roundtables, the guys that are Hispanic in Colombia start saying, you know, I don't like the way we have to do these things. Because they're working for the cartels. They're getting money and bribes. The cartel people are getting taken care of special. The average inmate that's there without any cartel money behind them, treat like a dog. Everybody knows you have better rooms, better food. You have even have a TV. And sometimes they have girls that will come in if you're really high up and have favor with the cartel. And the guards are getting properly compensated to set it up. What does this do in the prison system? This recruits for FARC and the cartel. That's what the General Cifuente said. I'm going to gut this thing right at the root. But he said, how do you change the prison system? Well, they knocked down the rooms that were all too large. They made every room the same. And they put the guards. Notice this. If you want to change culture, you start with the head. If you're going to kill a giant, you aim for the forehead. Just like David with Goliath, aim for the head. You got to go as high as possible. The gospel goes to kings and rulers. It's interesting. There's three categories of recipients for the gospel. The Jew, the Gentile, and their rulers. The third category in Acts 9 is kings. Most of us miss the kings. We focus on the poor and the outcast. But you're supposed to aim for the forehead. Go for the highest ranking people. So the guards are the ones who went through the training first. They're the ones who got dealt with. When they got dealt with, they converted not their faith, but their behavior. Because their conscience collectively reinforced the fact that they were no longer happy being on the take with the cartel, and they were hoping their children wouldn't have to continue on in a culture that was like them. Their family was part of the motivation. The facilitator is a Christian, not allowed to preach. They just kind of keep egging on. Fuel on the fire. So I met the guards. The guards were the reason why the inmates wanted the program, because the guards stopped acting abusive and corrupt. They stopped playing the games they were playing, and when they noticed a change in the guards, they wanted the same training. Imagine that. The inmates wanted the same training as the guards. I went in, met the inmates and the guards, and interviewed them. It's totally legit. The murder rate was down to zero. And what Cifuentes did was, when he came out into recovery, he says, he calls all the wardens together. He's put in charge of the national prison system. He said, we're going to change this violence. We're going to transform this nation. We're going to do it with this institution first. We're going to eliminate the corruption that is in the prison system and work our way out to every level of corruption. Powerful. He said, understand, two of the rebels were caught. You have them here. Two of the wardens go, yes. He goes, good. So you have them and you have them. So that's where the two of those guys are that killed my son and shot me? Yes. Yes, General. Good. I'm going to leave the room. You are going to move them to another prison, and I am not to find out where that is. If anyone tells me, you will lose your job as a warden. This violence stops now. He was telling them he was not going to exact revenge for his son's death. Now they know he's practicing the new values. Could have easily said thank you, and then just taken care of two hits in those places, and they would have all understood it. He didn't have a plan. The power of intention created it. And here's the shocker. I meet the guy personally. He's assigned as an ambassador to Aruba. I have a time sharing Aruba. I interview him myself. I heard about him. I've been to Colombia, but I hadn't met him. Now I meet him. He had to leave because after the Escobar drug cartel came down, for his own life and for his own safety, he had put so much heat on the drug cartel and FARC that they moved him out as an ambassador so that he wasn't going to get blown up or shot. I said to him, General Cifuentes, the forgiveness, the willingness not to take revenge, the pursuit of principles and values. I got to know this. So how did you first meet the Lord? When did you first encounter God in your life? I said, when did you, Jesus, first, you know, come? When did you first hear about Jesus? He goes, well, I don't know. I was Catholic, raised Catholic. And then it slowly dawns on me. I'm assuming this whole time that I'm dealing with some super saint that has this mystical encounter with God, that is motivated by the love of God, and in spite of every yearning in his carnal nature to exact revenge or to feel like a victim, he overcomes through the sheer grace of God. This guy isn't even born again by our definition. Then I remembered something John Schrock said. When he started his program, he said he started writing this curriculum because he said there'll be a point in time. He had a vision. He saw a scroll of time, and boom, a finger comes down. And God says, there will be a point in time when great crisis is going to come to the earth, but I have already prepared. And he said something interesting. He said, I have prepared for leaders. They will have the faces of lions, but the hearts of lambs, and they will not be religious at all. So now we have to begin to entertain the fact that the key players we might be working with are people like General Cifuentes, who God has prepared to be agents to deal with systemic evils, and they're not out to get people born again, filled with the Spirit, and make churches flourish. That's the furthest thing from their mind. They're out to eradicate poverty, kill off the rebels, and stop the corruption. Now, if we can enter in as Josephs with dream interpretations that match that agenda, you'll have plenty of leverage spiritually over their spiritual life because they've got wives, they've got kids, they've got problems, and the door always opens to minister to people at a level outside of the context of your consulting assignment. Because once you have credibility, you can spend that credibility any one. It's a currency. Does that make sense to you? So go to Isaiah 45. This is crazy. You heard Daniel, Paul Jelly was talking about now. Daniel's going to be ministering to, these kings. Well, here's one that's just a freaky verse I never thought of before. It says in chapter 44, verse 27, "It is I who says to the deep, be dried up, I will dry up your rivers. It is I who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, he shall perform all my desire. And he declares to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple your foundation shall be laid. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed." Is Cyrus his anointed shepherd? Whew. This must be some favored lover of God. Even says here, verse 2, "I'm going to go before you, make the crooked places straight, break in pieces the gates of bronze, and shatter the bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness to hidden." This is Cyrus, a secular ruler, "so that you may know that I am the Lord." What? "Oh, that I, the Lord, who called you by your name, am the God of Israel. For Jacob my servant's sake, for Israel my chosen one, I have even called you by your name." Like 150 years before the dude shows up, Isaiah prophesies the name of a heathen ruler who God will anoint to be a shepherd for his own people's sake. And then says, "I have named you though you have not known me." Circle it. You haven't known me, you're anointed. So this is why Christians have to change, and I don't think we can have the possibility of the brain transfusion we need as quickly as we need it. But when I first went up to meet Donald Trump, the Lord said, "Isaiah 45 for the 45th president of the United States. Start praying it." I said, "Oh my God, if it's an Isaiah 45, then it's someone who doesn't know the Lord." But you see right there, anybody who's a card-carrying Christian with their checklist in their pocket is an anti-Trump person because of his background, because of what they think about his, he's faking out Christians and gullible Christians. No, we're not gullible. We happen to see an anointing on someone who doesn't know God, but who honors him. Because contrary to what you think, getting the most Christian guy in the White House isn't winning the game. Either that or you need to get rid of all, like my dad, my dad's apartment, my dad's cupboard. He never throws any food out. He's 97 years old. He's still doing Zumba classes. He's quite a character. I go look at his cupboard. I go, "Dad, you got to throw out some of this stuff." The A1 sauce was actually packaged during the Carter administration. But by the way, the Carter administration was where I got an education that simply getting a born-again evangelical in the White House isn't winning the game. If I have my kids serving in combat, I don't know. I don't know if I want him with the nicest Pentecostal or with Patton. And maybe not with Patton, but I want him with some general. I don't care if he's cussing or what, that he knows how to fight. So I'm saying to you, so I'm up there at Trump Towers. I don't even know how I got there. All I know is I had a vision I was going to be there. And I'm sitting there. And it's crazy because I made a comment to Daryl Scott, who's this black friend of mine, on the phone. I said, "Yeah, I'll go. You know why? Tell you what I think. I don't think this guy's an evangelical. I don't think he's a Christian. I think he honors God. He's got a Bible. He believes in God. His mom taught him, you know, to reverence God. That's how come he contacted Paula White. He watched her on TV once. He doesn't know much, but his mother taught him how to identify it. It is the anointing. And he was watching her on TV, and he said, 'I don't know what it is. My mother told me that identify it. Whatever it is, you got it. And I want to help you.' So I'm starting to hear a whole other side of Trump. Trump doesn't like people to know about that because he likes this tough patent brand. He thinks this is the image that the presidency needs for the next crisis hour. Someone who's bodacious and overconfident. And so I'm sitting there telling Daryl, I go, "So Daryl, I tell you what, I just flip open my Bible. The Lord says 45th president." I didn't know it was the 45th president, but I check it out. It's the 45th president. It's the next one, Isaiah 45. And it says, "Cyrus, my anointed, my wrecking ball." This guy's breaking things open, smashing things open. This is like this guy's campaign strategy. He's a chaos candidate. I said, "I'll tell you something else. The reformers had a theory about this. The reformers' theory is that God restrains evil through a grace that he puts, just like in the prison system, like General Cifuentes. It was God at work on him. How many of you know that? But it wasn't saving grace. The guy ain't born again. It's called common grace. Common grace is a theological concept we ought to wrap our arms around, hug and kiss, because it's where God comes on heathens that don't know God, but they affirm justice over injustice and right over wrong. And even though they have systemic corruption, common grace is what holds the world back from being totally taken over by the demonized, self-interested condition of fallen man. So I said to him, common grace is what is on Cyrus, not saving grace. And it's the grace of God for an anointing, for an assignment. So what happens in my meeting? I go to Trump Towers. I'm sitting there nice and quiet in the corner. I'm with a whole bunch of Black Lives Matter people. They're all upset with Donald Trump, but I'm like one of the sole solitary white people, but I'm used to that. So I just go, what the heck? This is my lot in life. I'm just can't kind of find my groove exactly. And I'm sitting there in the corner, and all of a sudden, Daryl, Mr. Trump, trust Daryl. He goes, Daryl, you know, anything you want to talk? They're talking back and forth, and I'm kind of hiding out and praying in tongues and thinking, I'm here for intercession. Well, all of a sudden, from across diagonal, across the table, Lance Wallnau, tell Mr. Trump what you told me about that Isaiah 45. You know, there ought to be a rule. Dennis doesn't practice it. Daryl doesn't. When I'm talking to people on the phone, they shouldn't repeat what I'm talking about. So I said, oh, well, I don't know. No, tell him. I think he needs to hear this. All you guys need to hear this. Go ahead. Tell the Isaiah 45 thing. I said, well, and I happen to have my Bible with me. I don't know. It's just a religious insecurity. I take my Bible out of my briefcase, put it on the boardroom table. Mr. Trump, you'd have to admit that your candidacy is a bit unusual. Most people would have been self-destroyed, destruction by their, if they did what you did. You know, Washington, actually, they say that his horses were shot out from under him. He had bullet holes in his coat. It must have been like the hand of providence on him that kept him from getting killed. And I think that's part of your campaign strategy. So, listen. I said, now, in the Bible, it says right here, Isaiah 45, the Lord says to Cyrus is anointed. Now, I have to tell you, even though you're telling us about your evangelical, you know, reaching out, and we appreciate that because you do respect God, and you do respect clergy, and you respect the Bible and Billy Graham and all, we get that. But truthfully, it says, according to this, it says Cyrus is an anointed one who God's hand is on in the 45th chapter of Isaiah. I think this, Isaiah 45 is for you as a 45th president of the United States. But it says that you don't really know him. He didn't like that part. He's like scowling and go, but listen, it's okay. Because the hand of God is on you for the assignment, and the grace of God is going to show you who he is. Because I think God's hand is on you. In spite of the chaos of what your candidacy looks like, I believe hand of God is on you for good. And we are here with you. You don't have to sell yourself any harder than this. And so, then Daryl goes, tell everybody here about common grace and saving grace. It's like, oh God, Daryl. I'm giving him that look like husbands try to give their wives. Like, stop it. He can't see. He's just one. So, common grace, you know, is the grace of God that comes upon Churchill, Lincoln. Two historical figures that weren't the darling of evangelicals. When will we wake up? Well, is he born again? Who cares? Is he anointed? And does he have a core set of principles and convictions that are so much a part of his DNA that they exude out of him under interrogation? This isn't some kind of an opinion. You know, let me tell you something. Like with Trump, I know some of his opinions have been adjusted for social issues. But his core fundamental sets are actually very strong on what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's false. He calls himself a practical conservative. He's not an ideologue. He's not that way. He's an intuitive conservative. And his values actually are coming more and more in alignment with the Bible all the time. And he believes that the God's hand is on him. And it's interesting. The catalyst that he told us was actually caused him to run for office was a woman. For all the sexist accusations he's got, he always wanted to be president. He's always been ambitious and precocious. And his wife told him the last 10 years, no, you'll never make it. You're too smart and you're too brash. Your personality's ill-suited. You could be a president, but you don't have the temperament. People won't put up with you. One day, she was watching the news, and they were just watching, I don't know what it was. It was some moment of meltdown in American culture. And she got a revelation, like Pilate's wife. She got a revelation. She said, Donald, I'm convinced if you ran now, you'd win. He said, stop. You're telling me all the time I couldn't. She said, I know. Something's changed. Something in America has shifted. And now they're ready for you, and you don't have to be anyone else other than who you are. So whether he makes it or not, that's the inside story of my journey with Donald Trump. But what it supports is the thesis that our job is to be dream interpreters for Cyruses who don't know the Lord, and our first order of business isn't getting them converted. It's about interpreting the dream they can't put together. Now, they've got the dream. Nebuchadnezzar had the dream, not Daniel. Pharaoh had the dream, not Joseph. President whoever will have a dream. But they can't execute it, because that's where the church finds its indispensable role comes in. All right, let me run through this stuff real quickly. So, making sense of what has happened, Dennis said it yesterday. Have we learned anything about how culture is shaped? I'm going to run through this real fast. Making sense of what has happened. What have we learned in the past? How the left built the most powerful coalition. How did the left disciple America during the last 20 years of Toronto and Brownsville and TBN and church growth and church planting? And how many conferences have we all done? How many prophecies have we prophesied? Well, let's study what the left did. After the losses in the election of 2000, the left realized they needed to rebuild their movement. Political players like John Podesta, Harold Ickes, Rob Stein, Sid Blumenthal, and others came together to develop a strategy to fill the voids in the leftist movement. The group developed a firm called Thunder Road, based on the song from Bruce Springsteen, which was to fly at 30,000 feet. This is the Statesman Project, done by the left in the year 2000, that we're still trying to keep up with. And it was 30,000 feet to evaluate the needs of the left and find ways to fund those needs. I'm sorry, is that bored in the way? Over the next 10 years, the most powerful political coalition in history was built and funded by coordinated giving. Here's the plan. Survey the strengths of the conservative movement. Now watch this. I'm going to show it to you. Since you moved the board, it's a good time to use it. It's kind of like kitty litter. Every now and then, once you lay out the fresh litter, somebody wants to use it. Okay, so... so here's what you got. Here you got the wall around Jerusalem. So think of this as a reverse Nehemiah project. What the left did was they evaluated where the Christian conservatives and evangelicals in marriage, in education, in various places, where the gates were that fortified the win for Bush. And they decided, like a Napoleonic strategy, to create entirely new siege engines that were going to go against those gates. They knew where the strengths were. They knew where the weaknesses were. They knew that they could mobilize. But they had to have a hub strategy. So they created Thunder Road. Thunder Road would be for them the strategic game that would link with either Hillary or Obama, depending on which one won the election. And they would join Thunder Road with the next administration, and the juggernaut would begin to reshape America. Now, watch how brilliant this is. They surveyed the strengths of the movement. They identified the organizations that were effective against the strengths. And they recruited them to their Statesman Project, where funding and strategy were coordinated. They created new organizations, important footnote, where they didn't exist. They created independent organizations. And they set them as siege engines against the conservative camp wherever it could be exploited. On the ground, leftist strategists and financiers realized the leftist movement, in order to effect change in America, needed several critical factors. Here it is, what they created that no Christians don't even know about. In that meeting, they created a think tank, which they call the Center for American Progress. Notice the language and the branding that is used. Marxism and communism is classic. It's the Workers' Party. It's always some slogan. Black Lives Matter, for instance. It's always a slogan that you have a hard time coming against because it seems like you're a racist. So, you know, Jesus Christ is beautiful. You know, well, who's going to fight that? We should try that one. A think tank. They created Center for American Progress. A media operation. They created Media Matters. Opposition research. The Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which is going to attack every conservative ruthlessly, right on down to the childhood photos that were doctored up by the mother. GOTV, which is Get Out the Vote, to go to Hollywood, to utilize artists, to be able to get the Arts Mountain to endorse liberal candidates so that they were cool to vote for the next generation. Open Society and Democracy Alliance, that's the main funding source, which ended up becoming George Soros' baby. And the social technology movement, MoveOn.org. They would hit technology and overpower the blog sphere and hire Michael Moore to do documentaries and run the organization. This is what you do, guys and gals. You find out what the strategic, ideological strong points and weak points are of a nation, And then you create siege engines that go up against it as single-issue organizations. And here's the secret, which you guys are intuitively following. You don't create one organization with all of them linked together because it's too easy to attack, like the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. If you want to affect culture, you have to have a dozen seemingly independent gladiators who somehow show up and lock their shields at the right time in the arena when the battle starts. So, many other organizations were created. But by the way, notice that each one of them has its own logo and its own brand and its own 501c3, c4 and funding source. By aligning the organizations with existing organizations and the unions, already a big organization working on the left with $70, $80 million funds that they can put into their political mischievous alignments. They were able to bring everyone into focus as one to participate in whatever single-issue coalitions to drive policy. So if they're going to be doing Obamacare, if that's what's going to happen, they all oars go in the water on that one subject, and everybody's pushing. And you would think the whole nation is behind it, when in fact it's a coordinated assault on the American mind. All right, so the left political funding source. There it is, coordinated giving from the think tank in the middle, Thunder Road, and there's the entities that they created. So what do? Typical strategists, they don't have a lot of money, but they make a lot of money off of campaigns. That's how political consultants make money. So they take a list of the top 100 donors to the Democratic Party, the left party, the leftists. The top 100, the key criteria was they have to be able to shell up $1 million if they like the ideas. They have to have a record of being a $1 million giver or more. They bring 100 of them to, out there to, I think it was out in Long Island, out in the Hamptons. They rent the place. It's a cool weekend, you know, and everything's really upscale. Soros is there. All the guys are there. Blumenthal's there. James Carville. They have this meeting just like us. But in the audience are 100 potential donors. All that they do is they say, we don't want 5, we don't want 10. We just want 1 million each. If we have 100 million, we can fund the assault in the next, and we will within the next two cycles in America, we will shape this conversation so we will never be dominated by the conservative movement again. They succeeded. While we prayed and fasted and travailed and bound and loosed and built and prophesied and wrote our harbinger books and our victorious eschatology theology. Everything except organized and did something. Then we build a theology to justify the mess we're in. That's Soros' network of giving. George himself funds all of those, but all those organizations are loosely tied together by a web, a mischievous web of deception. But you can go to, if you want to go to discoverthenetworks.org, you can find Discover the Networks. It has all these networks there. Some bold, courageous Christian did that before they left the country. What would be the conservative counter to Thunder Road? Well, obviously. The conservative counter to Thunder Road was none. That's why we're talking right now. By the way, here's the wacky thing. You're not the only group in Dallas is meeting this month. I mean, Bob Daley, Bob Williamson, Tom DeLay, who gave me part of this presentation, former speaker, a whip. Melly Culberg-Cohen, a Sturdy Veritas foreman, about 50 other high-rolling investors and stuff. None of this was recorded. I couldn't make it. I was supposed to help facilitate it. They just met here 5 days ago. A whole other group like this. That's why I say we're like flanks of an army that don't even, we're walking around in the night not even knowing who each other is on the field of battle. So we got to get everybody together. But that group is called, interestingly enough, the Jesus Alliance. I mean, who's going to fight the Jesus Alliance? Jesus Alliance sounds, it's as simple as it gets. Jesus Alliance. It centers on Jesus. And then you decide what part of the battle you want to get into, what part of the game you want to play. But Jesus is the central, it's a call to courage. It's a call to, at the end of the day, you're either with Jesus or you're not, and at some point you're going to pay a price for knowing him. And so it's an alliance. But then there's the As One America, America As One, which is meeting again in a couple of weeks, and that's a whole other group. But conservatives prefer to operate through independent silos, engage in traditional strategies, and work in the past. You guys see that? Conservatives don't work together. Liberals, Code Pink, the LGBT community is right there in Ferguson with all of the Black Lives Matter, plus the New Black Panther Society, plus four of the organizations, and they're all funded organizations. And we don't have a single Christian organization that I know that shows up in anything that's funded to go there. What you got is Bart Pierce telling us his people will go down and pray voluntarily because they happen to live in Baltimore. That's not exactly a national SWAT team response. That's a beautiful representation of local church leveraging all that it's got. Liberals work together, combined with left-leaning support from journalists, bloggers, media personalities, and academia. All that was needed was an activist recruitment, directing, and funding procedure. How effective has that competing strategies been over the last 6 years? How about us versus them? No doubt about it. We lost. Now, what are our needs to recover ground? We need a think tank. They created Center for American Progress. So is Statesman going to be our think tank? Then we have to think about, what are we launching? If that's it, then we should own what part of it it is. Is it economic policy and educating the body of Christ? And that ought to be what we own. And we're not, don't take on, same-sex and gender issues. Let somebody else like Michael Brown, who loves that, let a pugilist go after it. And by the way, we can't all be, here's another mistake we make. You need all types in the battle. You need Ann Coulter on the front lines with her own sassy style, because you need people on the front lines that punch back at the front lines. We also need our Mother Teresa's, our Joel Osteen's. We need our lovers that are, and then we need our covert statesmen that are just staying out of the fray and above the conflict. We need all, but we need a centralized commitment to each other. We need to know how to support each other and not attack each other or under-support each other. We need a media operation. They created Media Matters. What are we going to use? A coalition of existing and new media outlets to promote positions affecting public policy and to expand grassroots organizing. Opposition research. They created Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Somebody's going to have to do their research on who's emerging and who they're tied, like Discover the Networks. I want us to know who's funding who and what their ideological, maybe communist background is that they're doing a makeover on in public. GOTV, get out the vote. Here's what I'm thinking. Family businesses. We must focus on connecting with the 10 million small business owners who are Christians. This group impacts 50 million connected employees. There are 30 million small businesses in America. It's the greatest untapped economic source of coherence in the American political system. Dennis's influence is with, my guess is with pastors and business people, primarily. So small business ought to be a no-brainer for us. A funding source. They created Open Society and Democracy Alliance. We will appeal to those who see our organization as the best alternative to counter the left. As the election process goes on, win, lose, or draw, there is no draw. It's win or lose. Then the money, we have to go back after the money. The money that was out there trying to accomplish change in America based on political strategies. I think those are conservatives. Many of them are Christians. They just don't have an alternative. They don't have a thunder road to talk to. But trust me, they're not stupid. If they see something that's got the right people involved, they'll fund it because the money's there. David Greenwood, Hobby Lobby, puts $1 billion a year out to go fund causes. Bob Dallas has an X number of million-dollar tech fund that's just done to go help the Body of Christ do unity projects. I mean, the money's there. It's a question of giving vision to the right people in the right context. Social technology, we need our own move on .org. Oh, well, okay, I'm going to just go through it. Forget all this. We'll talk about this later. Anyway, final thought, if not us, who? If not this plan, what? If not now, when? America, as we know it, cannot survive another 5 years of liberal progressive dominance of culture. It can't just survive the economic policies. So who, what, when? So you guys really have a responsibility. I say get 100% behind what Dennis and the leaders here are doing. I mean, really get committed to it. If you're here kicking the tires, this is as good as it gets. Get here. But then from here, we need to identify the Jesus Alliances and the America as Ones and the CEO 12 groups. And we need to really create some kick-butt proposal, and we have to have our own Thunder Road meeting. And I'll be glad to do the pitch. But we need to start hitting people up for money, and we need to be getting organized, and we need to be moving very quickly. We cannot afford another 5 or 6 years of floundering around, just fluttering, shadow boxing is what we're doing. And all right, so that's the end of that show. I did promise you that I would show you what consulting tools I use. Can I take you on a quick survey of how you go into an organization like a Joseph and interpret the dream? You want to see how to do that? You want me to give you my secret sauce, my $10,000 a day bag of tricks? I don't know what I did with it. I can't find it. That's the irony of my gifting. I can transform your life, but I can't find my car. This is how the Lord keeps me in the state that I'm in. Desperate. Wait. Here it is. I found it. Thank God. Somebody prayed. Somebody prayed. No, I'm serious. It's embarrassing. I don't know where I leave my car. I can't find my room. I'm just like... I had one guy, actually. You know Ernie Fry from Massachusetts? Remember Ernie Fry from Massachusetts? This guy was a great pastor. I was on his board once. And he was so frustrated with me. He was trying to introduce me to someone. He said, Lance, how do you describe him? He's like an idiot savant. But somehow that doesn't sound very flattering, Ernie. Anyway, so this is a team alignment survey. I stick people's names in there depending on who I'm working with. This is Lance and Dave. Because Dave was the guy I was helping promote at that time. This is my stuff. So anyway, here's a dream alignment. So like you're a Joseph, right? A dream interpreter. Any organization. What I'm thinking of is how can you position yourself as a dream interpreter with tools that make you look smart, that take you incisively under the hood, and with minimal experience, you can become a real smart-looking consultant. That's what I'm trying to train our movement to do. So why does conflict exist in any team? By the way, this is just basic principles of life. You can teach this in a Bible study, but purpose. You have to define why you exist. And this is kind of an interesting question. In the hallway, if you really want to know how cohesive your project is, interview people and say, why do we exist? And you'll get like half a dozen different answers, and you realize you really got to get your message down again. Why do you exist? You have a team here. What does it exist for? Question of values. How are you going to operate? What are standards that you commit to working by and dealing with each other? It's nice to have them written because, you know, what makes for our friendship is we have them by virtue of socializing and hanging out. We know each other. But, I mean, as the organization grows, you got to actually have ideas. Like, what are the top five values we value transparency, authenticity. We value creativity and flexibility. I say those are four values right now you better grab hold of because that's the DNA of what your movement is. Vision, the expression of what team members want the team to become. What do you want it to become? What's your ultimate legacy? What's your ultimate impact? And then in terms of goals, what the team must achieve in the short term to achieve that vision? Procedures, what are the steps specifically you got to do to achieve those goals? Roles, who's responsible for completing the steps? Specifically, who does what? And communication. Team members must communicate openly and straightforwardly about all the above to achieve a high level of clarity and approval. I'd say they need to have a rhythm of communication. That's what I missed there. What it comes down to is two things, clarity and approval. Are we clear and are we on the same page? It's not easy to do because sometimes being clear, like, let me just say this. The smarter you are, the clearer you are, but the clearer you are, the less flexibility you have in changing what you're saying. But organizations require buy-in. So I'm throwing out a whole bunch of stuff. I'm throwing out stuff about Trump, about Cyrus, about God anointing pagans. That's a weird thought, but Isaiah 45 is saying these people evidently have something in their heart God says is trustworthy for his people's sake compared to the alternative, which is someone the devil wants to put in. By the way, if you want another verse for that, blows my mind. Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel 11, Archangel Gabriel says, I stood by Darius in the first year of his reign to confirm him in his office. That freaked me out because I knew Darius wasn't a rabbi either. So that means that archangels get involved with high-level warfare to make sure the right sinner goes into government. Right about the time when Christians don't want to vote, we just get stupid. It's like the last election. Well, you know, vote for the Mormon or the Muslim. It's like, well, that's really intelligent. That's redneck wisdom from Texas. Clarity. All team members must have a clear understanding of the team's purpose, values, and vision. But the approval part, here's the part I want to suggest to you is the secret sauce. Nobody checks this out. Hey, there's a dime a dozen instruments on rating an organization. How clear are we in our mission? How clear are we in our vision? How clear are we in our advice? But do they ever ask how much buy-in do people have on what we say? So you want consensus? Here's where it starts. I did my 7M team alignment report. Check this zap sucker out. This is so cool. So this is purpose, values, vision, goals, procedures, and roles. Every category that's indispensable that I just went down, you got to have it. I like to know, in an organization, how clear are they, collectively, on those categories? And equally, how much agreement or buy-in or how passionately committed are they to the clarity that they say they've got? And you'll find an interesting thing. People are probably no more passionate than they are clear. And if they're not clear, they're not passionate. But there's another thing. You can build a culture where you're assuming everybody's on board and they're not. They're just with you for other reasons. This is an actual organization. What does it tell you? tells you that there's a lot of white space. What's the white space? Untapped potential. It's money on the table. It's anointing not actualized. So that thing's grand. You don't need to put more money in that organization. You need to get the organization more organized. And it may not be the fact that then you got the individual slices of that. But here's what you do. You can have questions that you ask. And this is what you have as a facilitator. This is so cool. A facilitator has this. Everybody else has it also. It tells you the spread of buy-in and agreement and clarity. So, for instance, in terms of, let's pick something here, vision clarity. Our team is moving together in the same direction. Our team has a coherent plan for achieving our vision. This is typically the CEO. He's convinced he's on doing it. And maybe he's saying, somewhat agree. But look at this. Five people somewhat disagree. This is a real organization. I like the direction the team's going in. One person totally disagrees. Four somewhat disagree. Two people somewhat agree. Five people somewhat disagree. The strategies we have in place will ensure our vision will happen. Two people agree somewhat. Five. These are the conversations you don't normally have. You know why? Because of an artificial commitment to unity. Christians have taught perhaps one aspect of agreement. And that is that unity and agreement and submission and alignment is important. But the other side is, if you don't have a fully informed leadership team tapping into all the potential perspectives of the bright people in the conversation, then you're operating with only half your brain. So you're fully united behind half a brain. What you want to do is you want to solicit everyone's feedback and then be fully informed and make your decision. Does that make sense? But can you guys see how if you have the data? Here's the fun part. If you have this data and you have an asterisk next to where your name is on that list, here's the fun part. I know who is in disagreement with the other guys, but nobody else knows who they are. Because I don't give the names, I just give the numbers. So then in the conversation, I'm asking, well, Ron, what do you think about the vision? Now, I know Ron's in total disagreement. Ron, what would you say? Is there anything that you can add to this that can clarify a potential blind spot or problem that we're not thinking about? Yeah. Here's the fact. He might have something to say that the other five need to hear. Or he might need to rethink why he can join the other five just simply because he needed to be heard. But the point is, you can feel you're joining hands and praying. I guarantee your prayers to heaven are no more powerful than that level of agreement on that spreadsheet. We just got to pray. We got the money and the finances in. In the back of your mind, somebody's thinking, it's not the finances, man. It's the packaging. We got a great thing if we present it right. Or we need to activate our existing members to give. We don't need more people. We need to get the guys that are already there giving more. So everyone's praying, but you're feeling that kind of weird thing where you're trying to pray, and that's all, you know, but it's not necessarily bam, because you don't have alignment. I say that dream interpreters, rather than being some mystic prophetic acumen, actually are people that know how to create cultures of alignment and trust. Basically, we apostle and pastor organizations into functioning organically like a church, like a healthy family. A business, like a family, like a church, is a family of families aligned under patriarchal guidance. Anyway, elements that build trust. This is really important. AOCR. And that's acceptance. People have to feel accepted. And they have to feel as though you're receptive to their ideas. The organization has to be congruent in terms of meaning what it says and walking it soft, and then it has to be reliable and keeping commitments. And so here's the core values that build acceptance, respect and recognition. And it's where it starts. When people come in to an organization, they simply want to know, am I in welcome here? This is the first vibe you want to give. This is a church or team or organization. Do they feel welcome? And importantly also, are they respected for the contribution they bring, or are they just, you know, an audience participant? In terms of openness, are we receptive to what they're saying? And are we open in self-disclosing what we're thinking and feeling? Raising the bar of transparency. In terms of congruence, are we straightforward with dealing with what we need to be straightforward about? Are we honest about it when we need to be honest? And in terms of seeking excellence and reliability, it all comes down to excellence and keeping commitments. By the way, invariably, when I work in corporations, they're big on these two and weak on those two. That's the American business model and Indonesia and in Asia. Strong on excellence. We do excellence and we do it with a profit. And we mean what we say what we mean. And the leadership has to, you know, not be political. Let's do our job and line up and not do backstabbing and politicking. But what they're not doing is they're not doing the acceptance and openness, so they can't cultivate the other two characteristics. Because the drag is in, well, it goes like this. The drag is here in the communication. What you need is communication and consistency. So this is where Joseph comes in. Do you understand why there's really a big opportunity to get in and shape culture for Christians if they know how to play this game? Because the very area of recognition, respect, receptivity, and disclosure, those are hardcore skills for good Christians to be able to get people to open up. Intimacy means intimacy. I want them to see into me and me into them. And so we have a survey we could do that tells us exactly how much trust there is in the organization. Imagine that. Oh, we don't have time to do all this. I wish I could, but we don't have time. By the way, I do always have managers do their own assessment revelation over the group. Do you know why? Because the number one business of leadership is to understand how to read reality. And the number two business of leadership is how to communicate the reality they see in the most empowering way. Think about that. The two skills of leadership. The first one is to know what is actually true. You got to know how sick the patient is or how bad the corporation is or how dangerous the scenario. Then the other part, which is the art, you have to interpret that data in a way that inspires people to meaningful action. Therefore, you can't have a panic attack. You can't act like you can't take it anymore. You have to put on your game face. You have to put on Christ in an interesting way. So the first business of leadership is to be able to know reality. Second business is to find the empowering meaning. We will fight them on the land. We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them on the streets. We will never, never, never. So Churchill's genius was that he defined the ugly reality of Herr Hitler and the dark, sinister lights of a new dark ages, more barbarous and cruel than any other. He marshaled words and put them into combat. He didn't dance around the threat, but he infused the nation with the confidence that they could deal with it. That's the two gifts. It's the gift of defining reality for what it is, even prophetically, and it's the ability to inspire people to deal with the ugly reality. That's what our assignment is as statesmen, ultimately. I think that's our ultimate leadership role. But you see where those dots are? That's the manager, and that's the department they're managing. So what does this tell me about the manager? What does it tell you? Consultant Joseph, where is the leader in touch with reality? Very good. Where it comes to the organization's purpose and the organization vision, they're pretty much on the money. Where are they not reading the cues in the company or the department very well? Yeah. The values... Nobody's really sure what the values are. They may be in a brochure, but they're confused about what the heck we actually reward and compensate here. He's also totally confused about roles. He thinks everybody's happy with who's on the organizational chart. But there's no enthusiasm. I mean, there's some clarity, but even less excitement. Then there's procedures that he thinks things are a lot clearer about how things get done, but there's still confusion. Who navigates around the website? How do people join the organization? What's the procedure for getting requesting information? And then an approval that people aren't even happy about it. But then the big one scares me is this person really thinks the goals are all being embraced. The goals aren't being embraced. So I like this chart because this chart is always an aha. I'll tell you who suffers. The person who you... And this is amazing. It's so important to be an optimist, an encourager, kind of like a, what's it called, an armor bearer. But you see, the armor bearer, if the armor bearer doesn't see reality, they're not even helping the guy whose armor they're bearing. They're just going to get shot. So Optimism and realism is a rare gift. But real leadership is the ability to define reality and find the empowering meaning, not deny reality and stay empowered. Okay. Well, anyway, we have a profile for trust, acceptance, openness. We can actually tell how the... This team has got some white space there they can work on. They're balanced on their acceptance, openness, congruence, and reliability, but they could go further. They're not what I would call a level 10 organization yet. Well, any questions so far? And actually, it's data. I actually did that with a billion-dollar corporation, 10 CEOs, $100 million divisions each. It passes the whiff test at that level. They bought it, they got it, and we worked on it. And the number one reason why they don't have alignment around clarity and approval, number one reason, I slipped it there very quickly. I went from clarity on goals and roles and buy-in to trust. Why did we go to trust? Because the reason why they aren't discussing what they don't agree with is they don't trust each other in the conversation yet. They trust each other up to the level they're at. They haven't tested the waters when they disagree. So organizational trust is the issue behind the lack of alignment and the lack of candor in the organization itself. We're afraid to give feedback. And we're afraid to give feedback because we haven't created a way of measuring how much white space there is to go to. And then what kind of questions should we be discussing in order to find out how much can we handle? Does that make sense? What's scary about the American system is, I listened to the CEO of Pepsi-Cola, it's a lady, successful CEO, and they said, have you ever thought about politics? She said, think about politics. She said, how in the world could a corporation function if one half of the board of directors and employees were committed to the destruction and failure of the other half? Oh my God, was that an eye-opener? It was like Charlie Rose interviewing. He said, wow. She said, and if we had a business and a third of our board of directors were out to sabotage my success, they could torpedo our stock and kill our company. She said, you know, and here we have a country, which like a business is based on one side winning and one side losing. So to answer your question, we have to change the narrative. But to change the narrative, like I would say that we haven't even got the mechanisms down yet as Christians. And we could do it. Now listen. The question I'd love to answer that you didn't ask is what would need to exist to create the pressure on the process that makes that happen. The National Rifle Association has only 5 million members. It's one of the most powerful lobbying groups in the United States. Obama got a lot of what he wanted, same-sex marriage, Obamacare, but that guy's so frustrated because he could not bring in. He's trying to find another way to the Supreme Court. He can't stop the NRA. It's only 5 million people. It's 5 million people with money and leverage. We've got 30 million Christians in the United States. Now, supposedly like more than that, but I'm saying there's 30 million, at least 20 million, who are the Carter, Rubio, even a couple of confused Hillary people, and, you know, they're behind Cruz, they're behind Trump. There are Christians there. We could easily come up with an organization of 5 million that would be like the NRA. You have no idea how powerful it is. When you do a Thunder Road strategy and you've got 5 million people in one of those organizations or 2 million in one and 3 million in another, and they work together in the same battle?
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international nonprofit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.